Welcome to Chain Reaction, the Foreign Policy Research Institute's flagship network of podcast series examining the political, security, economic, and social trends shaping Europe and Eurasia. Throughout the year, we're talking with experts about developments in Russia's war in Ukraine, the new European security order, the past, present, and future of the Baltic states, Russia's political economy, and great power competition in the region. Join us each month for
Bear Market Brief.
The understanding of Russia, which is broadly as Russia is a great power that has its own special path, that has a mission, and that needs a strong state, you know, and a different path to that of the West.
I think when you look at these other industries, what you find is that there's a lot of pain built up in different parts of the Russian economy. Some of it's only going to be felt over a longer period of time.
Baltic ways.
There were the countries that when the war started, they were willing to be, you know, those voices of moral conscience.
The continent.
I think that this conflict today proves that we are able to go past grievances and that we are able to look into the future, into the common future together.
Report in short.
This is the real Achilles heel of Putin's mobilization.
And of course, our flagship Chain Reaction.
These two countries are interacting militarily or have been interacting in several different conflicts. And in some cases, they're on the same side, and in some cases, they're not.
New episodes are available each week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This week on Baltic Ways.
Hello, and welcome to Baltic Ways, a podcast bringing you interviews and insights from the world of Baltic studies. I'm your guest host, Ben Gardner-Gill, filling in for Dr. Indra Ekmanis. Lise Vesky is a research fellow in the history of political thought at the Goethe Institute at the University of Tartu. She recently earned a PhD in Central and East European Studies from the University of Glasgow with a dissertation entitled Towards a Stronger National Unity, Organic Statist Ideas in 1930s Estonia, for which she received an AABS dissertation grant in 2021. Her current project, the School for Democracy, Cooperation, Civil Society, and Intrastate Federalism in Estonian Intellectual History, 1900 to 1940, is funded by the Estonian Research Council. She has taught courses in the history of political thought, East and Central European history, and intellectual history of nationalism at the University of Glasgow, University College London, and University of Tartu. She also serves as an editorial coordinator of the Journal of Baltic Studies and editorial assistant of the Estonian Historical Journal. Lise Vesky, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me and taking interest in my research.
Yes, absolutely. So let's jump into that research. Can you give us a brief overview of how you came to study the development of Estonian democracy and the interwar period in particular?
Yeah, I think my interest in Estonian democracy in the 1930s maybe even began with interest in intellectual history, particularly intellectual history of nationalism. And I remember more than 10 years ago, this is a topic that my supervisor, Bertel Pirimäe, who is the professor of Estonian intellectual history at Tartu University, proposed that there was a specific topic, a certain young social scientist in the 1930s and his ideas on Völkerpsychologie and national psychology, national characteristics studies. And this is where I started from. And it has quite logically led to where I am now, because in my MA thesis, I studied ideas of national character and concepts of folk mind and so on. And when I started preparing my PhD project, I was thinking, what is it that I have been studying, more broadly? What is it about? And I realized that it has been very much about, defining the nation and what holds it together and what makes a nation stronger and all of this. But then all these ideas were somehow used, made into practical use in political debates. And one of the core uses has been various debates on democracy and authoritarianism and on various political kind of systems in the 1930s. And as many of you know, in 1934, there was a coup in Estonia in March. And after that coup, a new political system took hold. And before that, Estonia was a liberal democratic state. And after that, it became an authoritarian system. But it wasn't clear from the beginning what kind of state it's going to be. And this is when I started my PhD, I thought that I will be studying certain very particular concepts. And I think I was quite led by previous literature and the concepts that I was thinking I will be working with, or almost terms that I thought that I would be working with, were national unity, and particularly one term that corresponds to German Volksgemeinschaft on the one hand, and then also the term guided democracy. And I thought that there's two very central terms that were used by people who were political elites of that authoritarian political system. And then I went to sources, and my focus started to change, and it became so much richer what I was studying. And this is how it went on. Something that I did understand from the beginning, and I stayed on this idea or understanding, was that discussions on nationalism and ideas of nationalism and ideas of democracy were very much intertwined at the time. And we have to understand both of them, we have to study them together.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, that is a wonderful overview to get us to your research. Can you talk a little bit about then what the School for Democracy is? Just, it's a wonderfully simple phrase, but obviously there's a lot below the surface for your current project. How does it play with this interaction of you know, thought and action, so to speak, theory and praxis, one might say, in implementation?
Yes, maybe to again go back a little bit, because my current project grew out of my PhD project. I'm very much also continuing with a PhD project as well on 1930s authoritarianism, and that was in the end very much about the political language, but also how language and the political life are intertwined, and how they are linked, and how language, political rhetoric, creates political reality, and how concepts are never just empty words, some terms, some nitpicking. They have power of their own. Something that I found was that the authoritarian regime, the authoritarian elites, that they adopted a number of political concepts to justify what was happening, to justify the new regime, to justify their reforms, to display it as democratic in some interesting way. There was a whole number of concepts of illiberal democracy. That word wasn't used back then. There were other words such as managed democracy, conservative democracy, and so on back then. But anyway, they were used for certain very specific reasons. And yet another reason was that the political elites wanted to portray the system as a third way between liberalism that was outdated in their minds and just didn't work, and led to constant crises and change of governments and so on. There was need for something that was more sturdy and steady and firm, more organized. The word organized was always used. There was an idea that an ordered state, a well-ordered state, would be a good ideal, good goal to achieve. And on the other hand, there was also the same authoritarian elites were very much against totalitarianism, at least in their words. Whether it was sincere or not is another question. So they used these interesting new concepts to carve out this third way alternative. And at the same time, and where my own new research project started or started taking hold, was an understanding that, of course, there were people who were representatives of the democratic opposition and who were kind of taking notice of the new rhetoric and started to comment on it. And of course, there was at least de facto a censorship in place. So you couldn't say everything and then anything that you wanted and criticize things openly. But what you could do was to criticize, for instance, the same new and interesting words and concepts, such as the guided democracy, for instance. So you could ask, what does it mean? What does it mean that democracy can be guided or a state can be ordered? And this is where I guess I started to notice that there were some particular platforms where I could notice more of that sort of criticism. And one of these platforms was cooperation or cooperative movements, journals and newspapers and other outlets. And in somehow, maybe because they were more specialist, and that was the question that I had or a hypothesis for my new project. Is it because they were more specialist and more kind of maybe with smaller readership that these in these journals, political figures could maybe allow certain freedoms or were allowed certain freedoms in criticizing authoritarianism more than in other places? But also cooperation as such, it's of course a political or kind of economic movement. And when we think of cooperation, it is very typical examples are, you know, dairy cooperatives and cooperative banks and credit organizations and so on. But cooperation movement itself from the 19th century on, it has also carried certain intellectual underpinnings or ideological underpinnings. And it is very much kind of, its roots are complex, but on the other hand, it's very much also rooted in the 19th century liberalism and these ideas of individualism and so on. Of course, as one of the leading theorists of cooperation theories in Scandinavia, for instance, Mary Hilson has said, at some point, this meant that these ideas of individualism and liberalism that the cooperation movement was embedded in and was representing, like tolerance and religious and political pluralism and so on among its membership. And at some point, it became very like noteworthy, particularly in the 1930s context. And the way she puts it is that the same concept or phrase, "school for democracy," it was always there in a certain way in the cooperation movement. But then it acquired a new function in the 1930s, particularly from 1933 on, from Hitler's rise to power, because now it became particularly important to be, you know, tolerant and open and individualistic and so on. So she says that the school for democracy idea became explicit. It was now underlined. And the same happened in Estonia. And this is at least what I'm starting my project with. And I'm very much still at the beginning of it, but I'm trying to understand that I have already managed to study certain case studies or examples of how it actually functioned as a school for democracy. And why school? Some representatives or activists of cooperation, they argue that there are these like various aspects in the school of or in cooperation as a school for democracy. On the one hand, the same individualism, taking individual initiative, the same dairy cooperatives and dairy cooperative associations, for instance, these were small local communities. And this meant that everyone had a chance to participate. There was this idea of one member, one voice, and so on. So you could, the individual self-determination on this side. But on the other hand, you had to cooperate with other people who maybe had other or different political background, different political interests, religious background, and so on. So you had a chance to kind of, in a very practical way, act together with people who are different than you for some kind of common good on the local level. And this again became school for democracy or school for like some, there were other phrases here as well, quite often used, like school for tolerance, school for morality, I think. So this kind of very, very practical part or practical side of cooperation. And again, it's quite easy to see how these ideas could be used rhetorically in a context where you couldn't say everything. You couldn't really maybe promote individualism or liberalism or you couldn't really argue against authoritarianism in a way that you wanted to, but then maybe you could talk about certain values. And one of the representatives of or activists of Estonian cooperation theories, Jan Tõnisson, was in the 1930s. He became leading member of the democratic opposition in Tartu in southern Estonia, and he also was for a few years the first and only professor of cooperation at the University of Tartu. And again, like he used this platform very, very widely and openly. And what he said was that let's use this platform because authoritarianism, at least the way he framed it, and what he hoped was that authoritarianism in this period is, it will be brief. It's for, in his mind, it just went against the tide of history, the logic of history, and it's just brief. Let's use this platform of cooperation to outlive or outlast authoritarianism and retain some degree of freedom there. And there was another element of cooperation was education and civic education. And it's quite interesting how both the authoritarian leaders and then the democratic opposition, like both were talking about some sort of civic education, but what civic education means was a bit different in their minds.
Yeah, I think that the just going back to what you said is that terminology is never vapid. It is never meaningless. Like what rhetoric is used by leaders and by people in the civic sphere, it has meaning, right? And whether these are terms that we wouldn't use today or that have direct correlates today. So, for example, no one would use the term illiberal democracy in the 1930s in Estonia, but we would recognize the concept with illiberal democracies today. Civic education, which, you know, we can understand perhaps as people who believe in a liberal idea of civic education, perhaps as we understand people who believe in one could think of civic education also being a phrase from Orwell's 1984. So these sorts of things can get bandied about. I'm interested a bit in the challenges that this might create in studying, you know, nearly 90 years later now, these rhetorical shifts and sort of being able to put yourself in that mindset of like, okay, here's what these terms meant then. I imagine at a basic level, it's not that hard. You can get some correlates, you can get some one-to-ones, but really digging into it is quite challenging. So I want to dig into that briefly. Is just like, how do you keep your own glossary of like, here's what's actually going on with these terms, with this rhetoric? More broadly speaking, the process of integrating yourself into the intellectual life of, you know, the past is a different country, as some say, right? Yeah. Of 90 years ago, even though it is your homeland. Can you just walk through that process a little bit? Because I know that can be challenging.
Yeah. As I said at the beginning, I was very much led by secondary literature at first. I was quite sure what I'm going to study. Like, there were a few terms that I was most interested in. I was thinking I will study how various political figures, because I realized that various figures are using this term, and I was thinking I will study how they are using it. And then I went to the sources, straight to the sources, and started reading. And this is where things actually opened up. And I realized that, for instance, the same liberal democracy concept, or the concepts, the wide range of them. And I started noticing that at some point, there was almost like an explosion of various concepts. When at first you could see certain criticism of maybe even democracy, or at least some sort of democracy, and then little hints to genuine democracy that is better than the liberal parliamentary democracy. And suddenly people start, you know, throwing around these concepts. And there are various questions here, like why is it happening? Then you realize probably it is because they want to be democratic. They just don't like the political system that is in place. And then you start questioning or kind of thinking, discussing why did they want to be democratic, although in a very strange way. And what was democracy then for them? Because it's clearly something very different compared to what is democracy for us today. And then you start noticing, oh, but there are all these cognate or like adjacent concepts there, like the well-ordered state, and even where it's like ordering, organizing, reorganizing the society and the state. And you kind of almost start noticing a certain network of concepts. And also one thing that I was doing with some of the concepts, I tried to chase the genealogy or the lineage of when did they first start to emerge. One of the concepts that I was studying in my dissertation was the concept of social solidarity. And at some point, I noticed it in the later part of the 1930s and realized in the secondary literature, I haven't noticed anything about it. No one has written about this concept. And yet it emerged and suddenly it was everywhere. Again, where did it come from? Why is it this slogan suddenly? Of course, I realized that, again, it's so deeply related into discussions on democracy, because these people, again, they wanted to show that they were somewhere in between, not liberal democratic, but definitely not totalitarian either. And of course, solidarism, solidarity, who doesn't want to be solidaristic with their, countrymen? It sounds like such a positive, deeply positive concept or notion. And at the same time, it was used for such sinister purposes. For instance, the concept of social solidarity was integrated into a number of legal texts, like the Print Act and the Law of Associations and Meetings. And there was a clause that, for instance, the kinds of print texts that go against or that violate social solidarity will be prohibited. Of course, it's so wide enough and broad enough that, it could mean anything and everything. And at the same time, as I said, it seems like such a positive notion in a certain sense. So who would have anything against solidarity? And this is just one example of such terms used. And I found this rich history behind this term, for instance, this connection between Estonia and Poland. Poland that was also presidentially state, like Estonia. That was, of course, almost a bigger brother for Estonia at the time. There's a whole body of literature that talks about the center and periphery kind of dynamics and wants to de-center or kind of question the classic notion of ideas coming from the West to the East. And this is a good example of that. Yeah, in the 1930s, although it was never really publicly advertised in Estonian public sphere or in media, Poland was very much a very direct, practical example of how to justify the new authoritarian system. And one of the reasons why social solidarity became so popular suddenly was because of the Polish example. There, some of the conservative elites were promoting this term and theorizing on this term. And this is another kind of alley that I want to explore a bit further, with how deliberate it was from the Polish side. How deliberately did they promote their new political and ideological system, the 1930s one? And I have found some quite interesting examples how for instance, there were certain connections that operated between voluntary associations, Estonian and Polish associations, which sometimes were very, it sounds oh yeah, it's some random cultural association, but they were actually very political. For instance, here in Tallinn, there was this Estonian-Polish association created in 1930, where the leader, its long-term leader was the later deputy prime minister and minister of interior affairs, Kaarel Eenpalu. And there were other diplomats and military men and so on. So it wasn't just a random cultural association. It had a very concrete political dimension. So it's very interesting to explore how these networks were actually born on a practical level and how the knowledge exchange worked.
That is just fascinating, because the ability to dig into this as deeply as you already have and will continue to do so, clearly you're laying the groundwork for this new project in particular. You've really just, in the grand scheme of things, just started it.
Yes.
Is that you will be getting into vectors and details that just haven't been uncovered yet. As you said, social solidarity seems to be this big concept that sort of almost spins out of nowhere, it seems, and then has not received sort of requisite treatment. So really interested to see where that is going. And so I will definitely, and I know our listeners will definitely be interested to see what insights you can uncover. I want to, just as we're in the back half of our episode here, pivot a little bit. And that is to think about, as you're going through this incredible amount of detail on the political life and the intellectual life of the 1930s in particular, but interwar period more broadly in Estonia, You are also living through a very interesting political time, not just in Estonia, as I think everyone can recognize, but the entire region. When you are simultaneously a citizen of the present and you are a student of the past, so to speak, are there particular things that jump out at you that you think not just you have learned, but are instructive potentially for us more broadly in our current times from the research that you've done?
Yes. Well, one thing is definitely the idea that I started with, that the political concepts have power and we have to be quite, as citizens, for instance, we have to be quite cautious and alert of how our political leaders, for instance, what their rhetoric is, what kinds of key concepts they are using, and what the political reality is that they are trying to portray for us or build or create for us by using these concepts. And the same illiberal democracy, for instance, that has come up a couple of times, I have been using it as a technical term, and yet it is such a maybe almost a vicious term in a certain sense, because it portrays for us this understanding that there is a kind of democracy there that, well, goes without free and fair elections, or where it's fine to restrict civil and political rights, or where it's fine that there is no separation of powers, or that is where there is no respect for the rule of law. And we have seen, for instance, when it comes to the immediate region, and that in the first decade of this century, of this millennium, when we think of Putin's Russia, for instance, it was described as a managed democracy by, well, Russian leadership itself, but also the West, maybe even more so. And it is a kind of democracy, just like not quite like the Western democracy, but I'm not sure if it was wishful thinking or what from the West's part. And now we know that already back then it wasn't a democracy, not at all. So maybe, and there are other leaders like that as well, when we think Viktor Orban, for instance, who has been playing around with the very term liberal democracy. We have to be quite cautious and alert when we hear words like that. And this is just one example of very many. So what are they trying to say? What are they trying to tell us when they are promoting these concepts? What are they hiding? And also, yeah, in general, like pay attention to the rhetoric. Sometimes this rhetoric also tells us something about the role models. Like, for instance, in Estonia, some of the maybe more populist powers have been, like, some years ago, started operating with some new concepts. And I remember when the concept deep state in Estonia, the Estonian equivalent, suddenly emerged. And like for a moment, I was like, where did it come from? And then I realized, and you realize these international connections and networks or understand where they lie. And I think this is, again, where language and political language can be very revealing about political realities.
Absolutely. I think it's important to know for folks who might be following politics closely today, and, you know, whether we want to or not, sometimes it's an imperative. But even for folks who aren't, to know that these concepts being bandied about, even if they're just checking in now and then, or even just to vote, to do their civic duty, you know, seeing where these candidates are coming from, where these parties are coming from, and they're making conscious choices here. It is not an accident. I think that's a wonderful message to take away here, both in the past and the present, that, you know, in the same way that we ascribe agency to all sorts of actors throughout history, and the discipline is broadening in a lot of ways, we have to understand that choices are conscious in a lot of ways, especially for those who have the power to make their choices freely. They are choosing to use these words as they do. So on that, I wouldn't call it a positive or a negative note, hopefully not too ominous. We are going to conclude there. Lisa Vieski, thank you so much for joining Baltic.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it, and keep us updated on the progress of your research.
I will. Thank you again for inviting me.
Absolutely. Have a great day.
Thanks.